I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 2nd of June. Many thanks to the multi-talented John Munson for filling in for me last week while I was doing virtually nothing. It's time for All Things Political, which you always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock. Mark Mardell will be with us this hour, North America editor for the BBC. He was previously BBC Europe editor, and he is soon to be returning to the UK to present Radio 4 World this weekend. He's been working in the States for 5 years now, writing about twists and turns of the presidency, electoral races, and life beyond Washington. Today, the EPA proposed a rule cutting carbon emissions 30% by 2030, and Mark writes that the president's stand is politically bold. The war on coal, though, will play hard in states like West Virginia and Kentucky, but it may help to ignite the base in other states. Is U.S. foreign policy vacuous and weak? Mark attended the president's foreign policy address at West Point's graduation ceremony. He answers the question, what did the president's West Point speech really mean, and how should terrorism be fought all over the world? We'll talk about the Tea Party. Conventional wisdom is that the tide has turned against the Tea Party, but Mark says it has already done much of its work pushing the Republicans to the right. Mark has done a documentary on the struggles in the Republican Party. So those are just a few of our topics this hour. Feel free to add to the list or comment on those already mentioned. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter @KDunnShow. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
So you're going home. Won't you miss us?
I'll miss you hugely. I'll miss all of America and traveling around it and seeing fantastic things. I'll miss the weather, even here in Washington at the moment. It's nice. And yes, I will miss the variety of the reporting and all the things I've seen. And there's just so much left to explore. But I'll have to come back for another stint when I've done a bit of presenting.
Good. Well, that will be good. You're always welcome, and always welcome on this show. We love to have you. Well, big news today on the environmental front, the EPA proposing a rule to cut carbon emissions 30% by 2030. The president really couldn't do much when it came to Congress concerning global warming, but this is a big thing for him to do, and obviously he's thinking about the future of the planet. It's an issue that's important to him, and so he's doing it by executive order.
Yes, and I think that, for a start, will annoy a lot of Republicans because they will say that he couldn't get it through Congress. Absolutely correct, he couldn't. So he's just gone ahead and he's doing it anyway. And it seems that on a lot of fronts, that's what the president intends to do, just push things through by executive order. Now, they will say, depending on their taste, that's either something between sneaky or unconstitutional. But it's also a gamble in another way. Obviously, that will annoy them. But they will come back, they're already coming back and saying, this is a war on coal, it's a war on American jobs, and it will cost the country dear. He's going to argue back against that. You look at the various different figures. The Chamber of Commerce say that it'll cost about 250,000 new jobs a year, and other organisations say, well, that's how many that will be created in other spheres. But the point is that there are states like particularly West Virginia and Kentucky, where Democrats are fighting very hard. These midterm elections are very important for them. And they will find the accusation that they're cutting jobs in the coal industry very, very hard to struggle against. And indeed, somebody from West Virginia, one of the Democrats there, has already says he's going to oppose this and trying to challenge it in law.
Mm-hmm. Coal companies have already announced that they plan to sue, right?
That's right. And they're warning that it's going to mean dire consequences, not just for the economy and not just for people's bills, but also saying that that the lights will go out. I was speaking to somebody from a power company about a week ago saying, well, we just can't do this without coal-fired power stations. What the administration would say is, well, you have to look at other ways of using coal, cleaner coal. And I think that if there is a war on coal, part of the battalion is also natural gas, because it is becoming much cheaper. And so that, you know, that there is a market force that is damaging the coal industry, as well as anything the administration might do to get cleaner air. So it isn't just what President Obama is doing. It is the cheapness of natural gas, and that's a result of fracking, of course.
Right. And in terms of wind and solar, would you say that those technologies are ready to step up to the plate here to replace coal, or is that a whole industry that has yet to be developed? What does the administration say about that?
Well, what the administration say is there's plenty of American ingenuity out there that can discover new ways of using these forms of energy. What I would say, I remember looking some years ago at the British energy panoply, and you know, even at the very best, even if you really push it, cover the landscape with windmills, have machines in the sea and all that sort of stuff, you can only get to about 14% of your energy needs at the moment. I suspect, and I'm no scientist, but I suspect what will happen eventually, but I don't know whether we're talking 5 years, 10 years, or 50 or 100 years, but somebody will come through with some big breakthrough in solar power, I suspect, and that will shift people away from carbon energy. But, you know, it's almost like fairy gold. I mean, whilst there is cheap gas, whilst there is coal, an abundance in America and China, that you can't expect people, with all the goodwill in the world, even if they believe all the arguments about climate change, you can't expect them to move off it because it is so tempting.
You talk about this being his last chance to substantially shape domestic policy, and also as a defining element, along with health care, as his legacy. What does it do to the rest of the world? If this goes through, is this a really big thing for the U.S. to do? Will China take note and respond accordingly?
I think that must be his hope. I mean, it was certainly striking to me watching our own output, the BBC's output on British television. You heard people saying, well, we're only a little island. You know, we're urged to cut back our demand and to go for cleaner fuel. But what difference do we make? It's America that makes the difference. It's China that makes the difference. And of course, that's true. And people in China are looking at what America does and will say, well, it's all very well for America to say stop developing this, but they're already a developed economy. We're in the middle of it. They've been through this. They can't tell us to hang back and to not develop our economy. But there's something else that almost maybe Obama's learning from China, because China was very reluctant to deal with the problems it's got. But then the pollution is so bad in Beijing and other cities. And, you know, you can be the elite of the elite. You can be the leading party official, but outside your apartment, your flat, you still have to breathe the same air as the hoi polloi as everybody else. And they don't want their kids getting ill or dying from this pollution. Now, what's striking to me about today's announcement is that President Obama and the administrator of the EPA are using not the global warming argument that we've heard so much about, that so many people in this country question. They're not saying the world is going to be filled with wars as the seas rise up and cover cities. There'll be a competition for food and for land, which we've heard that. No, they're saying, I quote from the EPA administrator, if your kid doesn't use an inhaler, consider yourself a lucky parent. Mm-hmm. And she goes on, rather sneeringly, at environmentalists and their general argument, this is not just about disappearing polar bears or melting ice caps. This is about protecting our health. So they've really switched arguments from the big global picture of, you know, this is about Gaia, this is about doing good for the planet, this is about your grandchildren's future. They're saying, no, this is about your asthma, your lungs. And I think President Obama, I don't think this is why he's the main thrust of why he's doing it. I think he is thinking about his legacy and what it means for the world. But the argument he's using here is rather abandoned, as I say, the big sweep of history. He's saying, you're going to get sick unless you do something about this.
But underneath it all, he is saying that he's doing it for the good of the planet, even though he can't say that politically.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think when you look at what the president is doing now, he's thinking of his legacy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe that's a rather dismissive way of putting it. And I don't mean it in that sense. I mean, I don't mean he's thinking about, oh, gosh, are they going to say I'm a terrible president or a great one? I think he's, you know, he was driven into this job because he believed that he could do good for people. Now, you may disagree with him, but I think that analysis is right. Perhaps more than other politicians, he thought he could change this country for the better of perhaps the less well-off in the country. But I think one of the things that he rose to in 2007-08 was about the environment. He said, this is a planet in peril. And I think to leave office and people just saying, well, you didn't do very much there, did mm-hmm. you, would be bad for him. And I think he genuinely wants to change this.
Mark Mardell is our guest, North America editor for the BBC. We're going to go into other topics, but this was a big announcement from the EPA today, and we thought we would reserve time right now for those of you who would like to comment on it. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we go to Greg in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Greg.
Thanks, Kathleen. Yeah, I just wanted to put in a few points. The Supreme Court ruled that the EPA had legal jurisdiction for regulating carbon under the Clean Air Act. That ruling was made during the Bush administration, who chose not to do anything about it. And then there were already Clean Air Act regulations in place requiring coal-burning plants to upgrade their air treatment systems to do things like prevent asthma and lung illness. So, you know, the Obama administration has waited and waited and waited, you know, for the opportunity for Congress to do something or create a compromise or partnership, and now they're taking executive action. They can try to challenge this in court, but the Supreme Court's already ruled on it. They have the legal authority. This is not the president acting in some sort of lawless manner. And it's very important to do whatever the reason.
Mark, thank you. Thanks for the call, Greg.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that the administration say we have rules via the EPA on lead in the air, arsenic in the water, so why not carbon? It's another thing that can damage health and can be poisonous. And I think Greg's right that there are already, the Supreme Court has established that he can do this. But there's no doubt, you look at it politically, he tried to do it through Congress, it would have been better. I think that he would regard it as better if they could have got an agreement with Congress. But, of course, we all know the atmosphere at the moment, not the atmosphere outside with carbon in it, but the political atmosphere here in Washington is such that they're not going to get an agreement, particularly now, particularly just before the midterm elections. Nobody's going to agree to anything that's controversial, right, particularly about this subject. So one can well understand why he feels he's got to force it through, but you can also understand the other side saying, well, look, we have a procedure, we have a system here, and indeed it's a system that is, and it's one of the things that intrigues me as a Brit and as an outsider, that it's not some sort of accident when we've heard over the years about, you know, gridlock and that sort of deadlock in Washington. It's not an accident. The system is designed to slow things down unless you can get agreement, and he hasn't got agreement from the other side.
Mm. Let's move on, although we can always return to this subject. You were there, the West Point graduation. The president was there as well for the first time in 13 years. A real possibility, he talked about, that none of the people in the audience, the West Point graduates, would die in combat in foreign field, gritty, snowy, sweltering, otherwise exotic, as you have described it. That's a significant change in U.S. foreign policy or not?
Well, I don't think it's a significant change from, 5 years ago, but it's a significant directional change that's happened under the Obama administration. After all, 13 years of war, very long wars, mm-hmm. and he is very proud. Again, it was something he was elected on, and I think we see him perhaps too much, in my view, going back to what he promised to do rather than what the challenges right now are. And one can understand that, you know, something that most Americans want, certainly most British people would want as well, is the wars in Iraq that's already over, a war in Afghanistan being brought to an end. And he's very proud of that, and he's saying that... I mean, I thought it was very Obama, because he's setting out very philosophically, almost professorially, when America should fight, when its core interests and its allies are threatened, and when it shouldn't, not just because there are dangerous developments in the world, not just because people are morally outraged by something that's going on. That's terrible, maybe something should be done about it, but it shouldn't necessarily be a trigger for action. And he used this phrase that just because we have the best hammer, it doesn't mean every problem is a nail, using that sort of a famous saying. So I thought he set out his foreign policy very well. I thought the problem was that that foreign policy hasn't been hugely successful in the world as it is.
Mm-hmm. He also talked about terrorism, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit. The growing threat of terrorism, if indeed it is growing, are the countries changing? Is there a large terrorist threat in Africa right now? The amount of money that is spent, and also the amount of surveillance that's being done. NSA announcing that they, or news reports that they were using facial recognition now on all kinds of people's faces. Is terrorism, did he outline that as the major threat in the world right now, Mark?
It's very difficult to say. There's a cynical part of me that thinks, well, it isn't, that 9/11 was a terrible, horrible event, and you can understand any president or any part of any administration thinking probably the most important thing they can possibly do is make sure something like that doesn't happen when they're in charge to another American or another city around the world. And indeed, there is a bit of me that says, you know, is the threat as great as they say? But my friends in the intelligence community say, and they've got a vested interest in this, of course, but they say, yeah, the threat is very real and very big. And I think that the difficulty now is that it doesn't just come out of Afghanistan. They probably have beaten back al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to a huge extent. But now we see what happens in Syria. If Syria became it's certainly a pretty lawless place now, but if it became the equivalent of Afghanistan under the thumb of extremists, would attacks on the West come from there? What about the places in Africa and Boko Haram? Now, most of these people that we label extremists at the moment are concentrating on the struggles in their own area and their own country. And I think that the administration here and others around the world in the West would be happy, not happy that they're doing it, but they'd be happy to keep them at that level. What they don't want is them to feel so secure they can carry out plots elsewhere and have the time and energy to do that. So I think it's understandable that President Obama will see this as a really significant threat that has to be kept under control.
And he evidently got wild applause. You were there. Tell me about it. When he talked about bringing people home from Afghanistan and Iraq, that those wars will soon be over. People thought that was a very good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I noted that some newspapers reported he only got a standing ovation from a quarter of the audience. And certainly when I spoke to people afterwards, you know, there are either those who thought he made a very wise speech or said that it wasn't there as a serving soldier, it wasn't their job to comment. But he certainly did get a huge cheer when he said that they wouldn't necessarily have to fight in Iraq or Afghanistan. And earlier the previous week, I was at a ceremony on Paris Island down in Georgia, where Marines were having their graduation ceremony, and talking to people afterwards, talking to their parents, and you know, you'd expect parents to say this, but of course they were all glad that America wasn't going around the world having wars, sending their boys and girls into battle. And I think that you know, most people would agree with that. Most people would be fed up with that sort of military action, and many people would regard as rather adventurism. I think the problem comes in the West Point speech where, I mean, he was, as I say, very Obama, very clear, very philosophical. But he's sort of saying to China, we'll defend Japan, but not Vietnam. He's sort of saying to Russia, yeah, we'll defend those countries that are in NATO, like Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania, but not Ukraine and Georgia. And maybe, you know, the British government used to use this this phrase, creative ambiguity, maybe a bit more creative ambiguity, a blurred line about when you wouldn't fight, might be better, might put off some potential enemies from doing stuff if they don't quite know where the red line is.
Mark Martell is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, and we welcome your phone calls. What do you think of American troops after a long, long time in Afghanistan? There will be advisors, but he says everybody will be home by 2016. Is that a good thing, or are we leaving that country in the lurch? What about this major announcement, the EPA proposing a rule cutting carbon emissions 30% by 2030, not playing well in some of the coal-producing states, and coal companies are planning to sue over the rule. Last week, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce issued a report warning that the rule could lower the gross domestic product by $50 billion. Or is it time, be it for health reasons or because the planet needs for these changes to take place, do you welcome this executive order? And whatever else you would like to talk about, we have yet to talk about the Tea Party, some primaries that have been taking place, a couple that will take place later this week, I believe one tomorrow, what happened in Texas, what happened in Kentucky. What about the Tea Party? Mark has done a documentary on squabbles within the Republican Party. Is it true that the Tea Party is kind of on the wane, that they're not needed anymore because they've succeeded in moving the Republican Party to a more conservative stance on many issues? We would love to hear from you, and here's how you reach our All Things Political conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Mark is North America editor for the BBC. He was BBC Europe editor before that. He's returning to the UK next week, I believe, to present Radio 4 World this weekend. He's been in the States for about 5 years now, writing about the presidency, about elections, and other issues. So join us. We'd love to hear from you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls, 800-486-8655. Daryl is joining us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Daryl.
Hello there. Real nice program you got. I want to talk a short bit about energy, coal.
Okay.
Coal, of course, is very embedded in our country, but we're having problems replacing it. Natural gas is getting plentiful, but it's also a pollutant to the atmosphere. I'd like to just mention that we have a proven technology using thorium for nuclear power that doesn't have the drawbacks of uranium and plutonium, and we have a supply that would equal 10,000 years readily available. We would have cheap electricity, and of course all the blessings that would bestow on us. It would kind of disrupt some jobs, though. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Mark.
I think that it's true that nuclear industry will get a boost from this announcement, and many people will look towards it. I remember doing a program on green energy in France, and they, rather cheekily, I thought, included nuclear energy as part of their green energy policy. Mm. Because the trouble is that, yeah, it is cheap and it is simple, but I think particularly after the Japanese disaster, and I know that's a different sort of technology, but it automatically scares people, because although it's not a risk of gradual slow pollution, there is the risk of a horrific accident, and however much the experts assure us that that is not the case, that's not going to happen, you know, that there have been these incidents, and it does worry people. And I must confess, personally, I can see a lot of the attractions and advantages, but I wouldn't like to live next to a nuclear power station. So, you know, I would share those fears on a gut level, and I think that's the problem with it.
You can imagine, can't you, that there's going to be a huge fight over all of this. There's been such a huge fight about global warming and whether or not it exists to switch, even though some may think that it's a modest EPA proposal, to make this change is really a large thing, to change the energy structure in this country and to move away from coal and to move into things like wind and solar really changes the way everything is done in this country. So there are a lot of vested interests who are going to say, I'm going to fight this tooth and nail.
Well, it does. And that's the other thing about the extractive industries. They make a lot of money for a lot of people. I'm not making a cheap shot at that. But something like solar power or atomic energy to a certain extent, once it's installed, once it's there, it just sits there and produces power, which in one way you can look as a great thing. You've done it, you've made the outlay, it's going to be cheap. But also you look at the oil industries, you look at the coal industries and gas fracking and all that. Look at the big boom in North Dakota because of fracking.
Yes, right.
That's an industry that's bringing jobs and prosperity to an area. A bit of a shock, actually, to that area. I've been up there, and it is a bit wild west in some ways.
Huh.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But that is an industry that, you know, keeps on giving in terms of for the shareholders and for the workers. So I think there'll be a defence of those sort of things because of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Daryl, for your call. Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Good afternoon. Perhaps, you know, our guest today is an Englishman who shares some of our same political terminology, but with different meanings, I think. Perhaps he can help me or help us understand what in America now defines conservative versus liberal. Traditionally, conservatism tried to conserve and preserve what was built and created in the past, and liberals were always moving on to something new and different. Well, if that's the case, then the Democrat Party in this country should be considered conservative, trying to conserve and preserve what previous generations have built and bequeathed, and the current Republican Party should be considered wild-eyed liberals who are trying to destroy and dismantle much of what has been created in the interest of something that they want to replace, and nobody knows exactly what it is.
it's a very interesting point, I think, that I sometimes joke that because liberal is used in a very different way here than it is in Britain, I sometimes joke that in Britain, Liberal Democrat is a party rather than an insult, which is the way that some on the right use it. And, of course, the gentleman's absolutely right. That, and I think it's not just true here. It's been true over time, certainly in Britain and elsewhere, that conservatism has moved on from the original dictionary definition of people who want to conserve what is to people who are quite radical. I mean, certainly I'd regard Margaret Thatcher as a radical. She wanted to change what was then the status quo in Britain. And certainly the Tea Party want to, as they say, take our country back. They want to change things. They would say, perhaps they would stress the conservative element of that, saying they're going back to something earlier, but they wouldn't necessarily bother with fighting that corner. They, I think, would be quite happy to say that they were radicals in a way that probably a lot of Democrats are not at the moment, because they don't believe the status quo works or should be maintained.
Mm. Let's spend a few moments talking about the Tea Party. I know you've done a documentary on the squabbles within the Republican Party. Is it on the wane? We're seeing some primaries here where more mainstream, if that's a fair word to use, Republicans have won races. And what effect has the Tea Party had on the Republican Party?
Well, I think there's, in one way, it's on the wane. I think certainly the Republican establishment got fed up with people being adopted who were bullying them, perhaps, and also changing the party in a way they didn't necessarily like. But more importantly, they thought were an electoral liability. Now, that doesn't apply to all of the Tea Party. Indeed, I know one arch-conservative here in Washington who said that when the Republican Party decided to say we don't want any more idiots elected, some people jumped up and said, how dare you attack us? You know, they were identifying, self-identifying as idiots. Now, so I think the Republican establishment has fought back against some candidates and has been, to a certain degree, successful. But then if you look at Texas, you know, they got the Attorney General through, that they've taken a whole load, the Tea Party have taken a whole load of posts at state level. And I think, so there's two points here. Their decline is overdone. But also, their argument with the establishment is about style. It is about tone. It is about strategy. Do you oppose everything that comes out of the White House, or are there some areas where you can compromise? It isn't really about policy and ideology. I mean, there are some things you can see a bit of difference on immigration. You can see a bit of difference perhaps on gay marriage, not very much. But on abortion, on the general attitude towards the economy, there's pretty much unity. And I think the Tea Party has acted as what I'd call a ginger group, a pressure group. It's pushed their party further to the right, to be more conservative in the general use of that word. So I think it's had a huge impact on American politics. And you know, beyond that, the impact is that Obama couldn't really get anything done when the Tea Party took the House back. And it's really stopped his agenda dead in the water.
Thanks, Kurt, for your call. Mark in Janesville. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, Mark. How are you?
Good. I just had a quick statement as well. I see a lot of disconnect in the conservative ideal of increased individual liberty through decreased government involvement. If I support that at a fundamental level, it makes perfect sense, but I don't think it's necessarily being applied universally. If official government of opposition to anything always requires more government, not less. So for a conservative to say we want more individual liberty through less government, except when we don't, like instances such as gay marriage and abortion, and in those areas we want more government and less individual liberty. Whether or not you personally agree with either action is kind of negligible, unless it's being subsidized by taxpayer dollars. I don't see why there would be any conservative opposition to it if the ideal is less government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting point there for conservatives, for people on the right, when they say that it's all about liberty. It's all about freedom. What sort of freedom? Whose freedom? That often means, here in America and elsewhere, the freedom to make money without it being taxed. It doesn't necessarily mean the freedom to smoke marijuana or get married to somebody of the same sex as you. Now, I would exempt, you know, libertarians are consistent on this and they're very controversial, but certainly right-wing libertarians would say, yeah, we don't want rules too much of any sort. We don't want the government in our lives. And it raises the point about what the Republicans do to their image when they insist on social issues. And, you know, I understand why they do, because I've talked to lots of people. I try to understand the Tea Party and the people who support them. And, you know, you can see the passion with which people talk about the social issues. So I'm not denigrating it in any sense. But one of my Republican friends here in Washington, who considers himself a moderate, says people look at the Republican Party and the Democrats and say, well, the Democrats want to get into my wallet. Well, I don't like that. But the Republicans want to get into my bedroom, and that's even worse.
Thank you, Mark, for the call. Wayne and Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Go Brewers.
Yeah, I'm going tonight.
Oh, you
with KP
kicker.
And Judith.
Are
we're
you
all excited.
Me?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So you're taking your number one guy.
KP and Judith and I are going, yeah.
Embark on what?
I got my Hank shirt on, Wayne.
Oh,
I know.
I love you. You're a true Wisconsinite. Don't always agree with you, but I like you. The point I'd like to bring to you, the guest, is I'm a conservative Republican, and and Kathleen's kind enough to let me on occasion, and I'm grateful to her for that. We don't get too many conservatives on WPR. I wished we did, but that's okay. One of the concerns I have with this president is the danger I see him posing to the Constitution, and I'd like to frame that in a very specific way. I don't know if you, I'm sure you do, Kathleen, and your guest, have heard of a professor named Jonathan Turley. Jonathan Turley is a Georgetown University Law School professor. And I would guess if he's on the Supreme Court, his decisions would align themselves very nicely with Justice Breyer. He is no conservative by any stretch of the imagination. But here's what he said, and I'll give you a direct quote, and then I'd like to hear from the guest. The problem with what the President, Barack Obama, is doing is that he's not simply posing a danger to the constitutional system. He is becoming the very danger the Constitution was designed to avoid. That is the concentration of power in any single branch. Jonathan Turley, University Law School, 2014. I'd just like to hear what your guest has to say, Kathleen.
Okay, Wayne, thanks for the call.
I think in many ways it's a fair point, and it's what I was saying earlier, that the system, the American system of government, isn't just, you know, occasionally, accidentally, oh, isn't it horrific, get stuck in deadlock. When there are different parties in control of one house and to the White House, that is designed to stop stuff happening. And if the president tries to get round that, I mean, and he does it in ways that we've said with the EPA, the Supreme Court has approved, so it's still within the Constitution. But, you know, you can tell that he does feel frustrated in that sense by the Constitution. I mean, as an outsider, I look at the Constitution and wonder, you know, is it such a good thing? Which, of course, is a horrific thing to say to many Americans and certainly people in the Tea Party. But a system of government that's sort of based on goodwill, you know, is it going to work? Does it work in the modern world? Because most systems of government, if you get people of different parties elected, they have to work together. Otherwise, they don't get those big ministerial cars and they don't get to make policy and they don't get to have a government. But here you can have one branch of government sitting there refusing to pass laws and everything sort of, well, doesn't go on as normal. Things are stopped from happening. It's designed that way because individual states were worried about too much power at the centre. It's not that different to the European Union, where I used to be based, that there's a lot of worries about the power of the European Union from Brussels. And so it's designed in a way almost that produces gridlock and muddle and no decisions so that things don't get imposed. But it doesn't make for speedy, quick, effective government in the sort of the internet age. Mm.
And when we take more phone calls and continue with Mark, we'll talk about the European Union. We have yet to discuss the New York Times reporting this weekend in their Sunday, that section I love, what's it called? Sunday Review. It should be a weekend review. The European Union, this article says, having its own problems of identity, election in all 28 member states to the European Parliament turned into a huge backlash against Brussels, immigration, established parties, national governments, and the very idea of a European Union. It goes on to say the most dramatic results were in Britain, where the UK Independence Party came in ahead of Labour and the Conservatives with 27.5%. We'll ask Mark about that. Plus, we have to ask him, we'll hold this off to the end. I don't know, there's a little bitty story in the Times on Saturday, and it has to do with what students are reading in the UK. The headline was "Goodbye Steinbeck, All Hail Shelley." The influential and controversial British Minister of Education who's been accused of jingoism, has new syllabus requirements that remove classic American works like To Kill a Mockingbird and The Crucible. We will talk about that with Mark. Mark is our guest. He's moving back to the UK, but maybe he can still join us from time to time. That would be good. He's been here for 5 years. He's the BBC North America editor, and he's going to be starting a new role as a presenter on Radio 4's The World this weekend and also presenting The World at 1 on Fridays. So you can probably pick him up online if you're not in the UK. And we'll take more phone calls, okay? Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go back to phone calls. We have many of them. Just briefly, though, I would like for you to mention about what's going on with this European Union vote, the Times describing it anti-immigration, anti-Brussels, anti-parties. What's going on? People don't like the union, or what is it?
I think there's a lot of discontent with the European Union all over in its 28 member countries. I think there was but there's various other things going on at lots of levels. So there's sort of a feeling that it has become too unwieldy. But I think also the feeling that during the economic crisis, it didn't do enough. It didn't work. It didn't sort of solve it or come up with any solutions. And it's also very convenient when when parties are in power get people voting against them, whether it's François Hollande in France or whether it's David Cameron in Britain, and they get a drubbing. They get thumped in these elections. So they say, oh, it's because the people really can't stand the European Union. Was it you, Mr. Hollande? Was it you, Mr. Cameron? Perhaps they were voting against. Oh, no, it's the European Union. So it's very easy for them to say that. But also at the same time, Britain has been changed pretty dramatically by a flow of immigration from Eastern Europe, particularly from Poland. And there are a lot of people who don't like it. These people come to Britain, do jobs cheaper than and jobs that maybe British people wouldn't do. And they're there, to me, in many ways, it proves the economy is vibrant and people are coming there for work. It is one of the things that the European Union was meant to do, was to see flows of labour between poorer countries and richer countries, just as you'd see it here between poorer and richer states. But people resent it. And we're going to talk about Steinbeck later, but I've just been rereading The Grapes of Wrath or Roth, depending how you say it.
Oh, Mark, that's so good of you before you get home and you can't even buy it in a bookstore, right? No,
that's
just kidding.
That's right, yeah. Well, I'll tell you why I'm rereading it. It's because my last gig here, my last thing is to do part of that journey again and reflect on how America has changed on the 75th anniversary and whether it says anything about Obama's America as well. But one of the things I noted from that book was, you know, because the theme about damn Okies come over here with their filthy habits and all that sort of stuff. So even within America, talking about, you know, white Americans talking about other white Americans, you know, resented that migration. And I think that's one of the interesting things in Britain, that this is not some, you know, racist attack on people from Asia or Africa. It's about Polish people who, you know, share many parts of the culture. And there is just a dislike of people doing cheaper jobs when they're a bit different.
Right, yeah. All right, let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I think that if you watch these debates in France, they are so superior to American political debates. Those people are so good, and they have such good debates. Why? We need to get rid of this two-party Bloods and Crips system and get into a multi-party system where you can have some real decent debates that the media can't cover up.
All right. Is it more interesting to cover many parties in Britain or in France?
I think it is. I mean, Britain is typically a two-party system, although we now have a fourth party and the Liberal Democrats are in government at the moment. That's very unusual. It is interesting to see people have that range of choice, but I wouldn't necessarily agree that the debates are better. I think one of the things I love about covering America is the vibrancy of the debate. And I don't mean when you get President Obama versus Mitt Romney. I mean going into any small town in any state and sticking a microphone under somebody's nose and you will get not only fantastic phrases coming out, you know, the great descriptive power of Americans, but also very intelligent, thoughtful debate behind it.
Let's go to Leo in Managua. Hi, Leo. Leo, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead. You're on.
I'm on?
You're on the radio.
Okay, I was just trying to make a comment. I'm listening to all this on the radio that you're talking about our countries and everything like this. Okay? The Obama thing where he's restricting us to 28 hours of work, okay? And if we go over 28 hours to impose penalties on our...
Yeah, don't listen don't listen to the radio. Turn it off.
Right. Okay.
All right,
to restrict us to 28 hours, okay, and impose penalties on our employer to do that. I'm 62 years old right now. Okay, I've been working 50, 60 hours a week all my life. Mm-hmm. And now we have President Obama, quote unquote, our leader, telling us that we can't even work the hours that we want to work. I believe instead of talking about all Europe and stuff like that, I think we should start
Yeah.
Caring about the people here.
Leo, I'm not sure.
That are 62 years old, that are retired.
Right.
And we can't now because they're taking it away from us.
I'm not sure what you're getting at.
We have food.
Right.
We have rent.
Right.
It's all you.
28 hours, where are you getting? Where are you going with that? You can't work.
They were told that President Obama is going to impose a penalty on more hours so that they have to pay the insurance. I don't need insurance. I got my own.
Yeah. All right. I'm not sure. We don't have enough
time. I think a 28-hour working week in America sounds most unlikely, and I haven't heard of that. I see some small investors magazine is claiming that it's an effect of Obamacare. I think that's what the gentleman's talking about, but
yes.
I don't quite see where it comes from.
Yeah. I'm sorry. We just don't have enough time, Leo. If you want to flesh it out and get back to us, we'll listen to what you have to say. All right. We got to get to this. He was described in the New York Times as the influential and controversial British Minister of Education, Michael Gove, who's been accused of jingoism, getting rid of To Kill a Mockingbird, The Crucible of Mice and Men, even Maya Angelou on the week that she died, to replace it with, you got to read Shakespeare, but an English 19th century novel. What is all of this?
I have to say, Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, hotly denies he ever said anything like this at all, and actually the exam boards that did it. But it has happened, and the idea behind it is they should study more English literature and less from around the world. I would go with one of our great poets and novelists, Kipling. What do they know of England who only England know? I think some of the most vibrant novels. I don't actually think there are very many good English novelists out there at the moment. There are great American novelists, great Indian, Australian and Scottish novelists writing in English. And I think it's a great shame if children don't get to study these fantastic works. I mean, as I say, Steinbeck is, I know that it was also noticeable that all the things that have allegedly been banned are coming somewhat from the left. And some people suspect there was a bit of a motive there. But as I say, the vibrancy of the language that you get, and you can, you know, you get it in English dialect as well. But I've been rereading Grapes, and this bit just caught my ear. Not because it sort of says anything, but just the use of language. It ain't a nice, excuse my accent, it ain't a nice place to sleep, said Rose of Sharon as she helped Grandma into the car. Grandma settled herself happily. Maybe it ain't pretty, but it's nice for nice, she said. And it's just, that's just so captures a sort of accent, a sort of attitude.
You're going to miss it here, aren't you?
I am.
I know, I can tell. Yeah.
The whole family is. We keep sort of stopping ourselves and saying, oh, we'll be gone in 2 weeks. It can't bear. But mind you, we're going on a nice European length vacation on the West Coast before we go.
Not bad. One more call. Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Going back to a caller talking about the Constitution, and I kind of share his concerns about President Obama perhaps violating the Constitution with executive orders. But what was ignored is the use of filibuster in the Senate. Word filibuster does not exist in the Senate. Supermajority is only supposed to be for certain things. And yet the Republicans have used it on a daily basis to thwart the majority vote. And so that's, you know, if things are completely kind of thwarted and stopped, it's because of that misuse, what I think of misuse of and violation of the Constitution.
Mark.
Yeah, I didn't think Ted Cruz reciting Green Eggs and Ham was necessarily the highest moment of senatorial dignity, really. When people... I can understand why they can't reach agreement. I understand why they disagree so much. But those sort of... I was going to say parliamentary tricks, but those sort of, you know, political tricks are deeply unimpressive, I think, for the rest of us. Well, I don't mean in the rest of the world, but, you know, the Americans out there hurting, wanting jobs, wanting things to go forward, to look at that sort of shenanigans is deeply unimpressive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mark, for your call. Mark, all the best to you. Please join us again. Just because you're in the UK doesn't mean we can't talk, right?
No, absolutely. I'll give you the view from... from London.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Mark Mardell, he is the North America editor for the BBC. He was Europe editor for the BBC. And as we've been saying, he's going to return to the UK next week to do different, same organization, BBC. He'll be doing a Friday show in World this weekend. He's been writing about the twists and turns of the American presidency, electoral races, and life beyond Washington. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee, where the sun is out now. We have news coming up, and we'll return with another hour.